Hey friends, want to let you know that I have a book coming out in March of 2024. It's called Exiles, The Church in the Shadow of Empire. If you've been listening to me for more than like 5 seconds, you've probably heard me use the phrase exile, or, you know, that we are exiles living in Babylon. And, you know, that's something I've said for many years. And so this book is kind of the culmination of my thinking through the question, what is a biblical theology of a Christian political identity? So this book does just that. It looks at how the people of God throughout Scripture navigated the relationship with the various nations and empires that they were living under in order to cultivate a framework for how Christians today should view their relationship with whatever state or empire that they are living under. So I invite you to check it out. It's available for pre-order now. Again, the name is Exiles, The Church in the Shadow of Empire. Check it out. Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. My guest today is my friend Josh Porter. Josh is a writer, a musician, and a pastor, and he recently released his book, With All Its Teeth, Sex, Violence, Profanity, and the Death of Christian Art. Josh is... he's not your conventional pastor, let's just say. He's an artist, a really provocative and profound thinker. I think he's a brilliant writer, and I just love talking to him. And this is a topic that he's thought passionately about for a long, long time. He's incredibly theological, very artistic, and in this book, he combines both of those themes together. And that's what we talk about. We talk about all kinds of things related to watching movies, Christian music, what is offensive? Should Christians watch offensive themes in movies? And is there such thing as Christian art? Is there such thing as Christian music? What about worship music and so on and so forth? So we do get a little bit edgy in this conversation, but I think we do so in a mature, tasteful way. So without further ado, please welcome back to the show, the one and only Josh Porter. All right, Josh Porter, welcome back to Theology in the Raw. I don't know what number this is, 2 or 3.
I keep showing up, yeah.
You keep tabs on this. So you have a new book out, which I usually don't just jump in and talk about people's books, but your books always have the best titles. With All Its Teeth, Sex, Violence, Profanity, and the Death of Christian Art. Can Christian art go too far? Is how I want to begin this conversation. Can we begin there? Like, I mean, you push the, well, let me know if you even like this phrase, push the envelope in artistic expression. Sure. That almost sounds negative. That almost sounds like a negative way of putting it, which I don't mean
not
it to be.
Me.
But okay, yeah. So why don't you start by giving us your, what is your theory or theology of art in general and Christian art in particular?
Well, when I first sat down to write the book about what it means to be a Christian and to not just make art, but to receive art. I think that, you know, mm-hmm. there are many people, as is my understanding, that kind of labor under this idea that to appreciate art or to even comprehend art, you have to be some kind of creatively wired individual or to have this unique palette, a God-given palette, if you like. And not only is that not true theologically, it's just not true functionally. You know, everyone is inundated all day long with all kinds of things that people have made, for better or for worse. You know, you'll look at screens and you'll sit on furniture and you'll eat food. And so to argue that art appreciation is unavoidable, or at least art consumption, receiving art is unavoidable, you have to work out a definition of what art is. That was pretty difficult. I thought that that'd be the easier part of the book. And you spend, I don't know, a couple of years reading through art theory. And a lot of our great, you know, art theorists have been figures throughout church history have been Christians. There's all kinds of different, you know, there's the imitation theory and there's the moral. There's all these different theories of what art is and what qualifies as art. So eventually I abandoned trying to get it from, you know, Immanuel Kant and Tolstoy and those people. And, this sounds like such a pretentious thing to say, but I actually tried to just do a biblical theology of art and what qualifies as art in the Bible. What kind of art does God make? What kind of art does God commission, and encourage? And the definition I use in the book is that when God or people make things that evoke ideas, emotions, or aesthetics. That's art. And so that definition doesn't have anything to say about like any moral character to the art or any kind of qualitative definition. You know what I mean? It doesn't say anything about whether or not it's good. Yeah. I find that when you ask people like what's art and what's not art, they tend to rush toward qualitative definitions. Like, well, you know, I don't know, you know, a film by you fill in the blank prestige director, that's art. But, you know, the animated a Minions movie, that's not art. But under the definition I use in the book, they both are. Because it doesn't say anything about whether or not you think it's good or what kind of aesthetic qualities it does or doesn't have. It's just when God or people make things that communicate ideas, emotions, or aesthetics, that's art. So I think, you know, by that definition, you open the doors to all kinds of like, okay, well, but that doesn't say any kind of moral thing about art or whether or not art can or can't be offensive, and according to whom, and what qualifies as quote unquote Christian art. And then, you know, I do that whole definition of art thing in like the first chapter of the book, and then the rest is arguing out all that other stuff. But the short answer to the question you opened with is, in my personal opinion, I don't believe that art can quote unquote go too far in the broad, like kind of, you know, objective sense. I do think that art can go, quote unquote, too far for the individual sensibilities. And that's where I would argue that things like, you know, conviction, discernment, accountability, and community enter in. But, you know, historically, I guess I shouldn't use, historically is too long sounding a term, but in modern church history, there's been a tendency to, you know, kind of react and say, this is offensive to me, therefore it should be offensive to everyone, therefore no one should be enjoying or receiving or even thinking critically about this art. And, you know, that's why I put all those buzzwords in the title, because those are the things that tend to color our conversations, at least in contemporary Christian culture or Western contemporary Christian culture, about like, well, is there sex in it? Is there violence in it? Are there swear words? And which has led to a kind of, you know, deficit in Christian art appreciation, at least in my personal opinion.
Yeah. Would you say that like the whole idea of Christian art, I would love to explore. I have another question, but it's kind of, maybe we should answer that question first. Like, what is Christian art? Because I've heard some people say, even like, or even like Christian music, that some people say Christian is an identity that a human being has. The idea of Christian art doesn't make sense. It's kind of a nonsensical, or Christian music. Music can be sang by Christians. Music can contain themes that are related to Christianity, but the very wording of Christian music is kind of nonsensical. I've heard people say that. Would you agree with that, or would you?
No, I agree. But I would, you know, at least extend the caveat that theologically, I agree that that's true. That, you know, like art belongs to God. He made it up. It was his idea, and he's the first and best artist. So art, even art that is quote unquote anti-God in its ideological content, they're still using a resource that God invented. So I don't think it makes a tremendous amount of sense to say like Christian art, because in a certain theological sense, all art is Christian, you know, in the idea that it belongs to God, God made it up. But I think, you know, functionally there's a reason that we use that moniker, you know, and if people, I don't mean to like, it's just kind of becomes a semantic conversation where someone's like a Christian band or a Christian movie. And I know what you mean by that. And it's almost like subgenres of music. You sound like a butthead when you're like post-hardcore indie, whatever. But to a certain person, that's helpful. You know what I mean? They're like, great, now I know exactly what you're talking about. And there is, you know, like, The Chosen is a Christian TV show. You know, what you fill in the blank, big worship band is a Christian band in the sense that it explicitly and expressly communicates Christian ideas at a surface level. And so in the kind of art and commerce world, you know what you're getting if I say Christian band or Christian movie. But there are a lot of great artists that make movies or that make music that blur the usefulness of that moniker, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, like if I say I'm trying to think of something big enough to use that everyone would, or a band like Switchfoot, for example, which has had a tremendous amount of mainstream success in the music industry. And I'm guessing a tremendous amount of people enjoy, without knowing that the musicians in Switchfoot are Christians or you know, because they don't sing songs that explicitly fit the kind of cookie cutter mold of what Christian, quote unquote, Christian music industry music should sound like.
Right.
But as I don't know Switchfoot personally, but from what I understand, that these guys are Christians and they've gone about their musical career a certain way that doesn't look like, you know, even a band like the band that I was in, which, you know, we sang about Jesus pretty explicitly all the time and used his name in our song lyrics. That was just an aesthetic decision on my part. It wasn't any kind of industry decision or ideological decision. But I think it's helpful, you know, in conversation to identify certain things as Christian, even though theologically I would push back on that paradigm, but I'm not trying to be a butthead. If somebody's like, "Oh, Switchfoot's a Christian band," I was like, yeah, I get what you mean by that. You know what I mean?
The whole concept is a little fuzzy to me because when you start exploring like what constitutes it, let's just stick to music for a second. And this, I feel nervous because you're the musician. Everything that's not a musician, but I love music and I love thinking about these things. What constitutes? When does something become Christian music? Like if it sings explicitly about Jesus, or what if it sings about true things in the world? What if it does it have to correspond with biblical themes? Well, then we can sing about genocide. We could lament the absence of God. I mean, if we sang some of the Psalms, like Psalm 88, where God, you would think the author, I think, is it David? I don't remember. You would almost wonder if he's a believer or not. He's almost like deconstructing, you know, where God, where are you? And there's no resolution. There's a ton of violence in the Bible. Like if we sing about the conquest of Joshua and the slaughtering of human children to clear the land for the Israelites and express, you know, bewilderment over this, you know, would that be a Christian song? Because, well, it's singing about a biblical event. What if you simply sang a song about breaking up with a boyfriend or girlfriend? Do Christians not break up with boyfriends and girlfriends? Is that not an experience that Christianity, is that a anti-Christian thing to do, to have a boyfriend or to break up with a, what if the boyfriend, what if it was, pushes you towards Christ to break up with his boyfriend? But, you know, you know what I'm getting, like, when does something, the line that I've sometimes said, and this may be totally wrong on artificial love to hear your thoughts, is, you know, is something promoting and celebrating a Christian view of things, which again can constitute God, where are you? I lost my spouse to cancer and I feel like you don't exist. It can be a Christian expression that can promote a Christian worldview because that's the Bible does that. I'm sorry, I've been too long-winded. Is something promotes a Christian view of the world or promotes an anti-Christian view of the world, celebrating vengeance? The Bible contains vengeance. It doesn't promote or celebrate vengeance. The Bible contains sin. It doesn't celebrate sin. So is that the line we're drawing? Anyway, I'm thinking out loud. Would love to.
No, I agree. I agree with everything you said. That's why I argue that theologically, the idea of Christian art doesn't make a ton of sense, especially when you account for the individual's interpretation, the viewer's interpretation, the reader's interpretation, the listener's interpretation. I don't mean to like beat up on, you know, the kind of quintessential Christian industry music or worship music or anything like that. I like a lot of it. In fact, someone made a joke with me the other day that how many times are you going to mention how awesome Amy Grant is in your art book? Like, so I'm a fan of these things. I'm not like, it's not a matter of like, oh man, we've done so bad, we need to do better per se. I think that, you know, can be argued point to point on certain things, but I think that, you know, in my life personally, the art that has most inspired me, and not just like, you know, I was entertained, which is a valuable experience, but not just entertainment and not just in the sense that, you know, I read something that inspired me to write, but inspired me as a disciple of Jesus and enriched my discipleship to Jesus, has been art that has either not been made by Christians or art that in some cases one could argue communicates something that is contrary to a Christian worldview. You know, when my mom gave me a copy of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar when I was in junior high or something like that, that was the kind of book that I was like, oh my God, I didn't know that a novel could read like this. And it made me want to be a writer. When I was a kid, my dad played me Aerosmith records. And I was like, I want to be in, this is awesome. I want to be in a band. Those were the kinds of early experience that awakened whatever creativity that I would argue, you know, is God given. But even now, you know, in the book, I kind of mentioned this experience of singing a song at church, which is, I like, you know, it's a worship song and I'm not going to bother with who sings it or whatever, but it was some kind of like a very basic, simple, and there's a value in this kind of lyricism, but I think the chorus was something like, be lifted up, be lifted higher. That's the chorus. And we sang it at church and it was a meaningful experience to me. Got in my car to drive home from church and started listening to a record that, you know, whatever was playing last on my phone. This is a record by a musician who's an atheist and a nihilist, and who uses biblical imagery satirically, you know, to kind of satirize certain themes in the Bible, or because these quote unquote archaic sounding ideas in the Bible are fun to use almost like, you know, like as word images. So I'm listening to something that was clearly meant to communicate something contrary to my worldview. And I was suddenly moved by the Spirit of God listening to this album and this song, not just because, oh, creatively, I like the musicianship. And, you know, that's an important factor as well. But it was the lyrics. It was the lyrics in a way that the author did not intend that moved me in a profound way. So, you know, I think that, you know, another example I use in the book at length is the horror film, The Witch, Robert Eggers' horror film, The Witch, which the only reason I use it is because there was this brief kerfuffle around the release, which, you know, I think was in 2013 where the Satanic Temple officially endorsed this film called The Witch. So the Satanic Temple is, you know, that kind of evokes this idea in your mind, but really it's kind of like not exactly what you think. It's some people on Twitter, you know, and they were, you know, heralding this film as this breakthrough against religious patriarchy. And I was like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. So I go to see this, you know, film. And to me, The Witch was honestly consistent with my worldview. You know, it was because in the worldview of The Witch, which the filmmaker is not a Christian, and I don't think that the filmmaker has a supernatural worldview. So he was playing it as a horror movie. You know, there's demons and there's the devil's real in the world of The Witch. And the things that demons and the devil do are bad, and a family comes to ruin because of it. So, you know, I thought it was actually kind of theologically astute and interesting, and aesthetically it was really interesting to me. And I left wondering why in the world it was endorsed by the Satanic Temple. To me, one could make an argument for, you know, The Witch as a quote unquote Christian movie in as much as any other, you know, like reading a story in the Gospels about demonic oppression and exorcism is a Christian reading experience. But at the same time, I would never then, you know, as a pastor, get on stage at my church and be like, everyone needs to go see The Witch, because I understand that people have different sensibilities. But the whole spirit of my book is trying to encourage, or even I might use the word push, Christians into a more robust palate that could possibly account for a film like The Witch or the album that I was listening to in my car, without necessarily, you know, clutching their pearls and, this can't possibly have any kind of spiritual value because A, B, and C, and learning to, you know, interpret art thoughtfully. I think that when Christians have a deficient spiritual discipline of art appreciation. It contributes to all kinds of problems, not just in like, oh, you're missing out on art. It goes well beyond that. You know, it contributes to problems with biblical literacy. And it contributes to, I would argue personally, like a deficit in a relational experience of God himself. That sounds really dire, but all throughout the scriptures, you know, God uses art and aesthetics, I would argue primarily, almost mostly to communicate to human beings, to when, you know, like when the majority of God's speech in the Bible is poetry, that when God presents himself to individuals in the Bible, it's always with these insane visions of wild, incredible things that are highly symbolic and in some cases terrifying. You know, when God communicates by the Spirit to individuals throughout the New Testament, you know, instead of just being like, hey, Peter, go to this guy's house and talk to him, it's like a blanket came down and alligators and, you know, whatever. Like, it's always wild, symbolic, and often kind of opaque and weird, offensive. Like, why doesn't God just say, go to the guy's house, you know, like it would erase the margin for error. And it seems to me that the answer is, well, God's an artist. He prefers, why, you know, in the Jesus, why would you not just say, hey, there's going to be this thing called the Lord's Supper, instead of like alienating an entire crowd of people by saying, you have to eat my flesh, you know, and everyone's like, what the heck is this guy on about? Yeah. Jesus is an artist. He prefers symbolism, even offensive symbolism, even at the cost of, you know, the audience's understanding or comprehension of the metaphor. He even goes as far as to tell his disciples, like, I'm doing this on purpose because it's going to enrich the experience for people who have ears to hear, and it's going to divide the crowd that doesn't want to understand. That if that doesn't sound like an artist, I don't know what does. You know what I mean?
I've heard from friends of mine who are much more into like movie criticism and film, and as you know, the artistic expressions of film. I've heard a lot of them talk about, you know, the horror, the genre of horror, being some of the most, they wouldn't say, well, maybe they would say Christian, the most, the genre that is most conducive for exploring Christian themes. You mentioned in passing the, you know, well, not, you know, the witch, and I mean, it's intrinsically anti-materialistic, or, you know, like, it's by definition, horror needs some kind of spiritual realm. That's a pretty Christian thing, right? It acknowledges, again, it's intrinsically acknowledging the presence of profound evil, even in the realm of some kind of spiritual realm. Like, these are rich biblical themes. Even if it didn't have an explicitly Christian theme, it does seem to open up Christian categories more than other genres. Would you agree with that? Is there something with the genre of horror that is Christians should, again, if they can't tolerate or whatever, if they're offended, and, you know, my wife can't stand, she would have nightmares if she watched anything with, you know, I remember watching The Conjuring in a dark hotel room by myself, and it didn't even, I don't know, I just went to sleep.
The Conjuring didn't do it for you. Yeah, I think so.
If that doesn't do it, I don't know.
I think, I agree, you know, horror, especially, I mean, I don't mean getting too far in the weeds of like movie history, but horror has had, a rich history of kind of existing in two worlds. And one is like, you know, popcorn horror, or like a roller coaster horror. It's for the thrill of, you know, haunted house. It's scary and it's fun. And, you know, Universal's like Frankenstein's monster and that kind of, all the way up to modern day, like, I don't know, the Saw movies or something like that. Ew, gross. And, you know, you have a thrill and then you leave the theater and you're okay. You know, so you get to like, explore these ideas of, what it would mean like to confront death or be terrified and survive. It's this roller coaster horror. But horror has also had this rich tradition of intellectualism all the way back to, you know, the late 60s with Roman Polanski, you know, Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist in the 70s. And on into a kind of horror renaissance with A24 Studios is kind of a movie house that puts out a lot of quote unquote indie or art house horror films. And then in between those two, there's an overlap of when those things come together in a meaningful way and you get something that appeals to a wide audience, but also has something profound to say about the human condition or human depravity or tragedy or death. So I, you know, I'm not describing these two realms as to say like one's good and one's bad. I think that there's a place for both in the Christian experience of, you know, what I call the spiritual discipline of art appreciation. If you have the palate to tolerate that kind of thing. And again, you know, I wouldn't tell your wife, like, unless you go see this movie, you're not a Christian.
Right.
But that said, you know, it's not that hard an argument to make, because when I sat down to write the book, I thought that, you know, it was going to, I wanted to make an argument for art that people might find offensive and for spiritual value in it. And I ended up doing, like, having to do a lot more work to get that argument across. I sat down to do like a biblical theology of the way, like I said, the way that God does art, the kind of art God commissions. And it ended up being, not to, like, you know, because obviously I didn't make it up, but not to sound like I've closed the book on it or anything, but it's kind of a slam dunk, you know, like from the very beginning to the very end of the biblical story, the kind of art and aesthetics that God likes, of course, you find beautiful, redemptive, like amazing, uplifting, encouraging all throughout the scriptures. And that's fantastic. But you also find, just like you were just saying, like all kinds of like horrifying, depraved stories, intense language, sexual depravity, violence that would make most of our horror movies look like Disney movies, and wild, dark imagery and symbolism. It's not just the Bible's depiction of history, which you could argue there's an aesthetic value in that, as God, you know, he's the co-author, he's the divine author with his human author. So the Bible says, in my theology, what God wanted it to say. And he's the one who said, yeah, put that bit about, you know, the death by gang rape in Judges or whatever it is. But that's documenting history. Even if you get away from documenting history, you have these horrifying poems about smashing babies, and you have Jesus's grotesque parables about, you know, eat my flesh and drink my blood, or the servant cut into pieces, or you have, even throughout the stories of ancient Israel, they're in rich symbolic sign acts that they enacted on a regular basis to tell the story of sin and salvation, involve things like slaughtering animals and sprinkling blood inside, yeah, you know, like the tabernacle or the temple. And it's not like, oh, in the ancient world, that was cool. That was not gross. You know what I mean? Like this was like a rich, right, symbolic and somber way that God's idea, asked for Israel to remember the story of sin and salvation and death, and or to keep these ideas of their own mortality and the consequences of sin ever before them. Like you said, if you read the Psalms, and these are poems, these are like creative, like artistic expressions of the human soul. And yes, some of them are so incredible, so uplifting and so amazing, but a ton of them almost sound nihilistic. They sound despairing. They sound borderline blasphemous, you know, like they question, yeah, the character of God or the presence of God. And you know, some of them then end on an uplifting note, and yet I will trust in you, that kind of thing. But some don't. Some like kind of conclude on this unresolved, like, that's it. Where's God? I don't believe that he is who he says he is. And then and those are designed for God's people to pray, you know what I mean? To enter into a meaningful relational experience with God himself. So, you know, if you have a problem with art that depicts things that are depraved or horrifying or violent or blasphemous, then you run into all of these problems with the scriptures themselves. And of course, you know, you can make, well, I'll take mine in the Bible, thank you very much. But I think it's worth asking, why would God prefer it that way? You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't have to require these kind of sacrificial codes. He did not have to, by his Spirit, inspire these kinds of psalms and say, yeah, put that one in the Bible. Jesus didn't have to teach the way that he did. These are artistic, aesthetic decisions. And they tell us a lot about the kind of art that God, the kind of artist God is, and the kind of art that God prefers, what God thinks is meaningful, what God thinks is communicative and powerful. So I think that that alone should tell us that there's a place for horror, you know, in literature, in film, in art, you know, and not, and even in visual art. If you look at like the art of someone like Francis Bacon and these kind of like nightmare visuals that hang on a museum wall, there should be a place for that kind of thing in the Christian experience of art.
Do you know any Christian that, like, is there a such thing as a Christian movie that's horror? Is that a, and why not? Like, we have Christian films, sort of, I guess, but they're all very, mostly predictable or just, we could talk about that. But I mean, the genre of horror is just not, I never heard of a Christian film producing a horror film.
Yeah.
Although there's plenty of biblical material that they can use to draw.
There have been these instances of, and this is going to sound like I'm trying to beat these guys up. I'm really not, but in the same way that we have films like Fireproof or,
like that kind of Christian, like explicitly Christian actors,
we have that kind of thing. At least I haven't seen them personally, but you know, I follow the movie industry and I'll see these kind of things pop up every now and then. And it could be the case that some of our more known horror directors or filmmakers or writers are Christian. And I just don't know about it. But if you look back again, like this is the second time I brought up The Exorcist in this conversation, but The Exorcist was overseen by a team of consulting Catholic priests. The Catholic priests, other than Father Karras and Father Maron, who are the two kind of protagonist priests in the film, are actual priests who were consulted on the film and who show up in the film and do a decent job acting as well. And so there's a precedent for filmmakers who William Friedkin, who died last year and directed The Exorcist. He wasn't a Christian that we know of, but you know, there's a precedent for filmmakers who understand, like, okay, so the worldview of the film I'm making is, in the case of The Exorcist, deeply Catholic. It's a story about Catholic priest and his experience of, you know, a demonic oppression of a little girl and a family. And so he was like, I want this to be authentic. And, you know, so he calls in Catholic priests to be like, would this be accurate? Is this accurate? And in that sense, didn't want to depict anything that, you know, a Christian would watching the movie would be like, oh man, that's not how that actually works. You know what I mean? So in that sense, there is a case for people trying to, or filmmakers and artists trying to anchor themselves in the worldview of the story that they're telling. I have a feeling every now and then I could be way off, but sometimes you see a thing that I think is so spiritually astute that I'm like, I wonder if that filmmaker was a Christian. You know what I mean? Like, or you read a novel and I'm rereading Blood Meridian right now by Cormac McCarthy. And I'm like, is Cormac McCarthy a Christian? You know what I mean? Like sometimes it's unclear, but in the very least, there's a kind of spiritual intelligence to the, and in my worldview, it doesn't ultimately matter if Cormac McCarthy was a Christian for me to have this profound spiritual experience of Blood Meridian. You know what I mean?
Well, he's created in God's image. There's general revelation. Mm-hmm. There's a spark of the divine in every image bearer on some level, right? So that's another question I have. When you have a movie that is produced and directed and written by somebody who's just not a believer, but it's just such a profound Christian worldview being expressed. The classic one for me is Gran Torino. I don't know if you saw that.
Clint Eastwood.
I mean, dude, it's got the most beautiful theme of redemption, even to where, I mean, it's been out for 2 decades, so spoiler alert, obviously. The redemptive moment at the end is him absorbing violence and falling dead in the shape of almost like a cross. And it's like this... feels like it was Kirk Cameron that, you know, mm-hmm. produced it, because it was just seems so explicit and moving a racist to not being racist anymore. I mean, on so many levels, it's just so many amazing Christian themes but most people wouldn't even pick that up, I don't think, unless you're kind of looking for it. But how do we explain that? Just that the we do have this kind of longing for Christ. There's an attractiveness to a Christian worldview of redemption and restoration and the acknowledgement of sin and that just humans are just going to be naturally attracted to on some level? Is that?
Yeah. And not only that, but yeah. You and I are Christians. So we understand everything that we receive on a movie screen, on the silver screen, as Christians. And so you and I can't help but watch Gran Torino and think like we're processing it through our understanding of the world as disciples of Jesus, which we should do. And so we can't help but see the cross shape at the film's third act, or to imbibe from it this powerful message about nonviolence, and the redemption, the redemptive work of nonviolence, absorbing violence, all those things. And, you know, so whether or not Clint Eastwood had those things in mind or in some kind of like, I believe personally that it could be entirely possible that I don't know this guy. So maybe he is, maybe he isn't, whatever, but it could be entirely possible that he's not a Christian whatsoever. And yet the Spirit of God, which, you know, we know through the scriptures, sees fit to communicate to people who aren't Christians, is communicating to him in some way and steering him to some end. And that comes through in the film, you know? And that's not to say that like, oh, anytime you see anything that could possibly be interpreted through a Christian lens, that was the Holy Spirit or anything like that. But that doesn't, even if that's not the case, it doesn't make it any less meaningful or any less powerful. And we should be, you know, you and I should be able to watch a film like that and ask ourselves questions about what it says about the human story and the world, and to have a room to discuss this in Christian community with other disciples of Jesus without the first, you know, flag going up being like, well, what's it rated? You know what I mean?
Right. So I've always wondered this, and I have some thoughts, but they're not very thoughtful. Like when do offensive themes become good art or bad art? For instance, you know, violence. I mean, Gran Torino has some violence, a ton of swearing, racial slurs, racism is bad. I mean, swearing, that's a different category, you know. Violence is not good, but real life contains all these things. And so, or the big one that I get asked a lot is sex and nudity. Like, is it ever okay for a Christian to watch a movie that contains sex and or nudity? Is there any kind of redemptive value there? Is it just simply if it's gratuitous? Like there's, like in Gran Torino, it's, going back to that, like the swearing and racial slurs that are in there, they were so essential for the true story to be told. You know, a couple old dudes living outside of Detroit that aren't Christians, and they're in the barber shop. Of course, they're in that day and age, they're going to be telling racial slurs. They're going to be ripping on each other. You know, they're going to be swearing all the time. The scenes with some of the gang, you know, gang members, they're going to be swearing. So it'd be dishonest to, you know, have them, you know, say, oh, shoot, or whatever. Yeah, you know, they're just not going to, that's just not real life. That's dishonest. With sex and nudity, is that a different cat? Like, that one gets tough for me. Is there ever like a place to say objectively for all people, all Christians, you should not be watching? I mean, I'm not talking like porn, but I'm talking like, you know, maybe like a rated R. Oppenheimer, people have asked me, you know, totally. I haven't seen it, but apparently it's got some nudity sex scene and they're like, should I watch it? Because the rest of the movie is really good. Yeah. And anyway, how do you categorize things that, when does violence become good art or bad art? Swearing, good art, bad art, or especially something like sex and nudity?
Yeah. Well, I'll start from the outset by saying I don't think that like blanket terms are ever that helpful, meaning like, well, this one piece goes too far and is thus off the table for any moral Christian. And I realize that, you know, like opens up the gates for, well, what about this one or that one or that one?
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing that I used to constantly argue, I think, you know, when I was coming of age as a young artist or art enthusiast or whatever, and into my early musical career, that I was arguing, it felt like almost unilaterally at the kind of conservative evangelical culture, was an artistic depiction of a thing is not necessarily an endorsement of a thing. And now I feel as if that is the conversation I'm having with the more progressive bubble of culture. An artistic depiction of a thing is not necessarily an endorsement of a thing. We can keep Gran Torino is a great example because it depicts racism, but it does so to condemn racism. And you can't condemn racism without depicting it artistically. The analogy I make in the book is like of a parent who wants to explain to a child not to use a swear word, and then has to say the swear word to say, this is a bad word, don't use it.
Those are fun moments.
And they're like, oh, okay. You know what I mean? Like, this is the conversation I've had with my kids, or they hear a word and they're like, what? They're saying it kind of wrong. You're like, okay, well, the word's actually this. Don't say it. You know what I mean? I'm depicting it in order to denounce it. I'm saying, this is the word. You're not going to hear me say it. You don't use it. You know what I mean? And I think the same goes in art. It's a conversation that I had early on when I started writing novels, or even in the music that my band would make. It was like, why do you depict these things, even fictitiously or even aesthetically, in your music? And you're like, the easy one is violence. Some of my novels have violent scenes in them. I'm like, I thought you were a pacifist. I'm like, I am. And so I write about violence. You know, like, I feel very strongly about this topic. And so how else to condemn it other than to depict it or to satirize it in a satire, you know what I mean? Like, or to, a book, like a writer like Cormac McCarthy writes about the horrors of violence, in a way that not only doesn't glamorize violence, it becomes exhausting. You're just like, gross, man. Yeah. Humans are awful. You know, that's the experience of reading something like The Road or Blood Meridian. So an artistic depiction of a thing is not necessarily an endorsement of a thing. And I think that that goes with sex and nudity as well. And I think that, you know, the argument that I would make is that, of course, you could present any number of exhibits in order to say, art and entertainment has dealt with sexuality in such a way as to provoke titillation from the audience. It's there to, in our kind of vocabulary, to evoke lust from the audience. It's, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Of course that happens. I'm not saying it never does. And that every kind of depiction of sex and nudity is like solely artistic. Of course that stuff can be in a movie or in a book or whatever, for the sole purpose of provoking the audience to lust. That said, to say then that like any kind of film that contains sex or nudity, or any novel that contains sexuality, or whatever it might be, a painting, is inappropriate for a Christian to appreciate or to admire or to just watch, gets you into all kinds of trouble. You know, if you ask someone like Tim Mackey at the Bible Project about what the heck is the Song of Songs? Why is that in there? He'll tell you, and I think this is in the language of one of the Bible Project's videos, that the consensus on, or, you know, like a lot of Bible scholars agree that it's a collection of erotic poems that is meant to be, I think in their language, read and enjoyed. And so it seems as, and if you read Song of Songs, of course, there's like, it, you know, there's some anachronistic stuff that's like, well, I wouldn't use these terms if I was trying to be erotic. But it's clear that it's over the top sexualized and gratuitous and very explicit. And even the metaphors are very thinly veiled. It's like, yeah, I know what that means. You know what I mean?
Right.
And God is the co-author. God was like, and put it in the Bible. You know what I mean? And there's a rich tradition throughout not just art history, but church history, of art that engages sexuality in a meaningful way, because that's part of the human experience, and not in a way that's meant to like, dehumanize people or to objectify people at all. You know, I tell this funny story in the book about how, often throughout history, the Sistine Chapel has been the source of division amongst, kind of sensitive Christian art critics. It was then, it is now. There's this kind of, and I don't mean this to pick on the guy, but I found this hilarious to me, story about John Piper visiting the Sistine Chapel and not appreciating, he didn't like the nudity. I think there's some quote where he says like, is God mooning us, you know, or some kind of thing like that, where, I don't know of many people, they must be out there, that would visit the Sistine Chapel for the purposes of, you know, like it, you know, provoking their own carnal desire. I think today, even those of us who don't consider ourselves like art enthusiasts would probably look up and be like, man, that's crazy. This guy painted all this. Wow. You know what I mean? And admire it in some meaningful way, or painting like the Venus de Milo or Michelangelo's David, that in their own times were questioned for their lack of restraint. Really? You have to put this right in the front of the painting. A film like Oppenheimer, you know, I saw Oppenheimer and I understand that kind of like, if someone were to say to me, like, I was told that Oppenheimer has this scene in it, and I don't know if that's great for me, I would say, I admire your self-awareness. You should, you know, as with anything, you know, the disciple of Jesus is to exercise the kind of discernment that's like, I'm going for holiness. I want to be, completely within the will of God in obedience to King Jesus. I think personally that that won't necessarily always exclude works of art that other people might find offensive or problematic.
So the older I get, the more challenging it's become to take care of my health. And this is why I've been consistently taking AG1 for over a year and a half now. AG1 is a foundational nutrition supplement that supports your body's universal needs like gut health, stress management, and immune support. Since 2010, AG1 has led the future of foundational nutrition by constantly refining their formula to create a smarter, better way to elevate your baseline health. And I can truly notice the difference. More sustained energy throughout the day, more mental clarity and focus, and I could live with the peace of mind that my overall health is being improved since I'm giving my body the nutrition that it needs. And even though I try to eat as healthy as I can, except, I don't know, the other night I literally put down 7 Jack in a Box tacos. I wish I was making that up. But in any case, I in general, I try to eat healthy, okay? But even if you eat healthy, it's difficult to give your body all the nutrition that it needs without adding some kind of nutritional supplement. And I used to take all kinds of pills and vitamins and green powders and all that stuff. But with AG1, I no longer need all that. AG1 is a complete and extremely potent nutritional supplement. So if you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to drinkag1.com/TITR. That's drinkag1.com/TITR. Check it out. I do wonder about, like, yeah, all the nudity in historic Christian art, which most of it was like nudity, it seems like. Like back then, was that seen as provocative? When Michelangelo carved the Statue of David, was that seen as, were people like, gosh, he's really pushing the envelope?
Yeah, I was surprised by that. You know, this
totally is not a big deal. I'm curious.
Yeah, it seems as if you go back through art history, and I think I approached it with this, because a lot of this I learned researching the book. It's not like, you know, I have some kind of degree in art history or anything, but I kind of assumed that something like the work of Michelangelo would have been regarded in its time as par for the course, you know, like, oh, that's the way we depicted things back then and people were less sensitive.
Right.
But not so. You know, there's been a long history of people being offended by something like the Sistine Chapel or Michelangelo's David, and for the same reasons that people today might be offended by the depiction of nudity in art. You know, and I think that, you know, I have a whole chapter about it in the book. It's called Sex, Porn, and Radiology Technicians. because you like my titles. That's what I told you.
Of course that's your title.
it's interesting to me, and this is something that I came to, you know, upon the course of writing my book, that in other vocations, we allow for, you know, the Christian to enter into certain environments in which they might have to engage the human body nude in a way that could possibly put them at some kind of sin risk, if you like. The analogy I make, or the, you know, the hypothetical I make, is of a radiology technician that does mammograms and, you know, woman that comes in, he's attracted to her, he's going to see her naked. It's part of his job. I don't know that his church community would necessarily be like, quit your job. You should not be in the medical field. You know what I mean? We would probably instead encourage him into a kind of accountability and discernment, that could steward him toward righteous behavior and that kind of thing. And yet with the arts, yeah, we treat them as if they're entirely expendable. So if there's any risk whatsoever, just cut out the art. There's no inherent necessary value in it anyway. So, but I think that like we need more thoughtful discernment. Not anything goes by any means, but more thoughtful discernment about how we approach even something like the depiction of sexuality in art.
I didn't even think about the relationship between certain professions that cause you to see explicit nudity that we typically don't. I mean, some people do raise, you know, when did the gynecologist, the heterosexual male gynecologist, decide this is a career path I want to go in? You know, like if he said as a 15-year-old, I want to be a guy, people probably think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Nevertheless, there we are, you know. But like, could that be a case to where Christians in certain contexts, I'm assuming, because of the context, can see and come very close to nudity, mm-hmm, in a way that's not sexualized, that's not a stumbling block, you know? And could that transfer over to the depiction of nudity or a sex scene in a movie? The problem is, though, like you said, I mean, in almost every instance, especially a sex scene, the creator is embedding this scene in the narrative to produce less. Not in every case. I'm trying to think of one where that wouldn't be simply gratuitous or to titillate. Is that the right word? That
yeah,
just sounds
it does. But you know, I think that the easiest way to find those examples is in the depiction of sexuality that is not romantic and is intended to disturb rather than incite some kind of lust or like, ooh, or even like, it's not even romantic. You know, there are what we would call, a tasteful is a strange word to use, but like a PG-13 love scene is not going to have nudity in it per se, or even a PG-13 love scene that does have nudity, like in James Cameron's Titanic or something like that. That kind of brought up this big argument about like, well, I mean, he's painting. So what is it? Is that sexualized? Is it not sexualized? But if you think about a film like Deliverance, which has this kind of infamous rape scene in it of men with a male victim, it's a hypersexualized moment in the film, and it is absolutely not meant to communicate anything that would provoke the audience to lust. Or even, you know, the novel and subsequent film adaptations of something like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which deal with sexual violence in a pretty explicit way, especially David Fincher's film adaptation of that novel in such a way that, you know, when I saw it, people were leaving the theater. It was so over the top. Clearly not meant to incite arousal in anyone. In fact, it's to the same end that I would argue, like, why put this in your movie? To condemn sexual violence, you know, to put the viewer in such a position where they're like, it's almost unbearable, and it incites.
They're turned off by the sexual
violence. Incites kind of a rage response as opposed to a lust response, and it opens. You know, and David Fincher's argument, the director of the American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, his argument was that he felt as if it was a cop out to depict, you know, a woman who's being overpowered by a male aggressor and then cut. You know, that's not. Accurate, and it does an injustice to the reality of sexual violence to not force the audience into some kind of experience of the shared with the victim. It doesn't create empathy. It doesn't create the kind of appropriate disgust over sexual violence. At the same time, there were people who would see something like David Fincher's adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and think it's completely inappropriate to depict rape in a mainstream movie or in a movie in general. And don't we have enough of that kind of thing? And on both sides, like conservative pearl clutchers and progressive moral police, you know, like you can't put that in a movie in the same way that they would argue for, you know, like banning books, you know, that they're kind of in cahoots, the conservative progressive circles on these things. Like if it's got this word in it, it's got to get out of the libraries. If it's got this scene in it, it shouldn't be in a film. So that obviously that doesn't do away with, or that doesn't resolve the issue of a movie like Oppenheimer, which has a love scene that kind of borders on both things. Because in the case of Oppenheimer, it's an adulterous love scene that sets up a tragedy that comes in the third act of the film.
So it's necessary for the story, would you say? Well, I mean, maybe they didn't need to reveal it.
I think, you know, saying something that's necessary for the film, it's like, who can say? Because you know what I mean? Like, the creative act isn't entirely objective. It's so subjective to say, to Christopher Nolan, apparently, it was necessary to depict. And I've, you know, seen enough. I'm not like a Christopher Nolan fanboy or anything, but I like some of his movies as much as the next guy. It seems to me that he's a very thoughtful artist, and maybe one of our most thoughtful living filmmakers currently, you know, he's one of our only, him and Denis Villeneuve, who, you know, has made the Dune films, most recently. Oh, yeah. And Paul Thomas Anderson, they're probably three of our, only living directors who make big budget spectacle movies that are also kind of like art house movies. Yeah. He seemed to think it was necessary to include this love scene between Oppenheimer's lover that becomes an indiscretion against his wife later on in the film. You could obviously argue like, oh, well, they could have just described it, or they could have depicted it in a less gratuitous way. But I leave those discernments to the artists, and I reserve my own discernments as the viewer, you know, and whether or not it's appropriate for me to watch. You know, I've heard from people that argue, and I understand why, and I understand that many times it's motivated by a desire for holiness, that's like, well, you know, it's just impossible. It's impossible for someone to see these things and not be titillated or not lust. But then that becomes, again, the whole like, so can our doctors, you know, we usually understand that doctors can enter into a mature position, even if they're heterosexual, even if they're prone to a kind of carnal mentality, that they should be able to exist and operate in their vocation without objectifying the people that they see as doctors, even if they see them naked, even if they see them in a way that to them is sexualized to some degree. I've got to assume that art, because it's so valuable to God, and because God is not afraid to depict sexuality in art, there's got to be a way for artists to work with the idea of sexuality and the human physicality, the body, in a way that was not lustful for them, not necessarily lustful for the viewer. But again, you know, I think that like Holy Spirit conviction, discernment have to enter into that conversation. It's the blanket statements that become, for me anyway, a bit problematic to say no one should, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And so much of it, it's not just subjective on an individual level, but also on a cultural level. Certain things are highly sexual and certain cultures just aren't in other cultures. I mean, I had a cousin of mine who was a missionary in Papua New Guinea, and you know, she said, I could walk down the street bare-chested with a dress on, no one would bat an eye. But if I walked around fully clothed wearing blue jeans, I would be, you know, but all the eyes of every man in that crowd would be groping me up and down, you know, like, my wife's from France. And so we've gone to France quite a bit. And dude, yeah, those beaches are crazy, dude. Like they, I mean, not only do you have every single male wearing a Speedo, which to my,
it's art. Speedos are.
but it's not uncommon to have, you know, a third of the women, you know, not wearing a top, you know, and it's like, but the thing is, in that culture, people, you don't, and I didn't know, I'm on the beach. I'm like, golly, you know, like I'm looking at my kids, like, all right, let me go find them, you know? But I'm looking around at the other guys and they're not even noticing. It's like, it's not even, you know, but it's like, wait a minute. I don't know. That's not universally this. It's not the same. If that happened in California, it would be like you looked around at the guys on the beach, and every single guys would be just solid. Oh, yeah. You know.
But even
and I'm sure there's other
the differences between a place like California and like Oregon. You know what I mean? California has a culture. If you go to Southern California, and to the coast, it's not uncommon for the dudes and the women to all be in their bathing suits, like at a juice bar. Or, you know what I mean? And no one's like, oh my God, I can't believe this place. But it's just not part of our everyday life in a place, in a cold place like Oregon. So if everyone was walking around and you know, it'd be like, oh my God, the indiscretion of these individuals. And not only does it vary culture to culture, the threshold of danger for the individual, for the disciple of Jesus, varies from person to person. You know, I've had people say, other well-meaning, intelligent pastors who would be like, well, you can't use Song of Songs because it's poetry. That's not the same as a movie. And then, you know, and this is a true story. Later that same day is the actual conversation I had with the pastor where I was in the middle of writing this book and we were talking about it. I go and meet with another pastor who's a friend of mine. She is a pastor of women and who was telling me, she's like, yeah, I'm working with this woman through a brutal sex addiction. And her drug of choice, if you like, was the written word. She read romance novels, short stories she found online that were erotic fiction was what she used.
Erotica.
And she, according to this pastor friend of mine, she's like, oh, she would probably be grossed out by something like internet porn, watching videos or something like that. But she's has a crippling addiction to this other kind of erotica, which is totally pornographic, because that's what incites that lust response in her, not this other thing. So the idea that, you know, and throughout not just church culture, but pop culture, we've kind of fallen into these stereotypes that like, oh, men are visual and women are, you know, idea based or whatever it is. And I've just not found it to be statistically or experientially true. It turns out that, especially if you're a pastor and you work with all kinds of different people and they're telling you like, this is the thing that, the sin that I feel as if I can't conquer, they're just so different. People's sensibilities are so different.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people that would have gone to see Oppenheimer and not just because they're so mature, but just because of their wiring and disposition, they probably would have been like, ew, gross. This is awkward and tacky to have this sex scene in here. And they probably wouldn't have enjoyed it and wouldn't have thought twice about it. But something else would really provoke them. So the idea that, we all have the same exact kind of fragilities isn't really helpful. And then it contributes to more blanket statements. Like, this is never good for anyone. This is good for anyone. And it takes certain meaningful works of art off the table that could enrich the spirit. You know, for example, if someone would have told you, that movie, this Clint Eastwood movie sucks, man. It's got slurs in it. That's never cool. That's never okay. Don't watch this thing. Then you could have been robbed of a meaningful spiritual experience. I'm not trying to like make it more than it was, but for some people, like, and myself included, I've had meaningful like landmarks in my discipleship and in my life that have happened in the course of reading a book or watching a movie or hearing some album that changed the kind of person I was or changed my perspective on the world in conjunction with like my relation, you know, like I'm experiencing them with God in a meaningful way. And it seems like, I mean, just read that Bible, man. If you go in there with scissors and you cut out every art installation and weird symbolic ritual and parable and poem and insane sign act, like an offensive metaphor, you'll have some genealogies. Even the genealogies have like, I hesitate to use a word like code, but yeah, there's an aesthetic value to the placement and the numerical values and who is in there and who isn't in there. Even the genealogies, there's so much aesthetic concern for even the construction of the Bible itself. You won't have any Bible left. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's made me think, I don't know why this came to my head, is something you said like 30 seconds ago, but I forgot what you said. Anyway, I don't think I've ever said this before, but the band that has inspired my Christian faith more than any other band is the band Rush. You might appreciate
it. Okay, all right, I'm ready for this.
Not so much. I mean, their lyrics are incredibly thoughtful. Neil Peart, who wrote most of their song, most of their songs, was a genius. I mean, he read like several books a week. Like big tone, philosophical tones. The guy was just a brilliant, brilliant guy, kind of a recluse. Like he was not known as being a very social person. Like after they, you know, play a concert, he'd go back to his hotel room and like read like Ayn Rand or something, you know, like that's just the way he was wired. So the lyrics the lyrics, especially the older stuff, were just incredibly intelligent. But they were, you know, obviously they made it big, sort of, but they were always very countercultural. They never played into what the audience wanted. They would produce and do music that they just really wanted to do, and they weren't controlled by what the audience wanted. And some of their albums just took off, 2112, Moving Pictures, and others. Then they kind of fell flat, and they really didn't care. Like, they were like, this is what we want to produce. They broke all the rules on, you know, and again, I don't know enough about music to know, but even, you know, the whole prog rock, I think,
yeah,
he helped me out here. Like, prog rock yeah. was kind of like, wasn't it kind of breaking kind of rules of music theory?
Yeah, if that, absolutely.
Maybe there aren't any rules of music, but they were just doing something that was just really different. I mean, 2112 is a 20-minute song with what, like 5 or 6 parts singing about some mythological world. It's just crazy. It's like ingenious. And they're like, you can't do a 20-minute song. You can't write a 5,000-word blog with tons of footnotes. Blogs must be 800 words. You can't write on this. You can't say that. And from the beginning of my kind of Christian journey, it's like, I don't tell me what I can or can't do or believe, you know, like I've had that kind of just, I don't know that like, no, I want to push the envelope. I want to help people think. I want to cross lines. I want to take risks. I don't want to play into what the masses want. And I just don't care. So I feel like they've almost inspired me in how I approach Christianity, even though none of them were even, you know, as far as I know, you know, even religious at all. But
yeah.
Are you a fan? Do you know Rush? I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would appreciate.
Yeah.
Rush
I actually just recently revisited. Is it 2112?
Yeah.
Because they use Tom Sawyer in the soundtrack to the Iron Claw, yeah. that film about the wrestler that just came out. And as soon as, you know, when the opening to Tom Sawyer, even just in those first seconds, and there's like the sound of a mini Moog goes synth, there's like, you know, and that drum beat starts. I was like, oh, shoot. But yeah, that kind of hyper literary prog rock. I think even as just someone who appreciates music history sounds pretentious, but like I like to go and find like, oh, why was this a big deal and listen to it. And I revisited that record and was just like, man, so it's amazing to me that we have these kind of icons of now it's appreciated for its thing. But I have to assume that even amongst Rush enthusiasts, there was a sense of like, all right, now we're getting a little weird. But that's one of my thesis statements in the books, in the book, is that, you know, there's this quote that I use from one of my favorite novelists who was asked in an interview, like, how often do you consider the reader as you're writing? And in a moment, reflexively, novelist said, I think verbatim quote. Yeah. I don't think about the reader ever. And I don't care. The reader is me. To me, I was like, freaking A, that's
my publisher. Would go for that.
Well, you know, there's different rules for, I would argue personally, something like Christian nonfiction, because, it's not a purely creative endeavor. It's a semi-creative endeavor. We have to like go for some level of comprehension or we're wasting our time. But, you know, in writing a novel or writing an album or painting a picture, I would argue that one of the most important values for any artist, and especially Christian artists, is to set aside concern for the audience. Concern for the audience inevitably creates even subconscious pandering to an audience. And you end up with these concerns about, like, well, will they get it? Will it offend them? And I just don't see that concern demonstrated by God throughout the scriptures at all. In fact, some of God's wackiest art installations or things that are, you know, think about like Ezekiel and the weird street theater stuff that he does with the burning of the poop and like the binding, tying himself up. that was God's idea. So God's like, go do this street theater. And we're explicitly told that like people aren't into it. They don't like it. It's supposed to communicate something powerful about Israel's sin and injustice. And before it's over, God tells Ezekiel, like, no one's going to get it, and they're not going to change. So to me, that was like a revelation, because it was like, so God already knows it's not going to, quote unquote, work. But he commissioned the street theater anyway. It's like what we would describe now as performance art. And it's purely aesthetic. There's like these symbol, you know, he ties himself up, he lays on his side, he burns. God wanted human poop, he settles for animal poop, all that kind of stuff. So it's offensive. It's like gross, and it's meant to be. And God knows that it's not going to turn Israel around, but he's like, do it anyway. There's a value in the art for the art's sake, even though it's not going to be understood by the audience, received by the audience, and not have the desired effect on the audience. And you get that kind of stuff all throughout the scriptures, especially, you know, again, with Jesus, with the whole, why do you teach like this? And he's like, it's on purpose. Or why do you say this is a hard teaching? Who can accept it? You know what I mean? So I think that when the great Christian artists enter into a given work of art, compelled by art for art's sake, even if it is ideological in nature, even if it has a profound ideological purpose, but they do so, it's just like, this is the way I feel like it should be, then those are the pieces that have the most profound lasting effect on the audience. It seems to me that, like you said, Rush must have not cared very much or at all about the approval of the industry, about the record label, about the audience, that Pert was just kind of like, I don't know, I read this sci-fi, you know what I mean? Like, he's like, I want to do a sci-fi concept record. And when what was selling at the time would have been kind of like sexualized glam rock, or when that was the new genre that was breaking through, and prog was, you know, the prog that Peter Gabriel and Genesis had kind of coined was already on its way out at a popular level. It's like, they're like, I don't care. You know what I mean? The songs are going to get longer. Yeah. And because of that, that's why they have the kind of iconic status that they have. I think that the more the artist exercises their freedom, you know, of expression, the more powerful the piece becomes, and the more that they ladle on, you know, the audience's expectations, the more they dilute the work of art. It doesn't mean that it won't be any good. It just means that there's a reason that we can sometimes tell certain pop music or mainstream cinema that could still have great artistic value, but it's like something designed by committee. It's like, you know, clearly they wanted this to go over. They wanted to hit these action points and selling items. They want to move units, and you end up with something entirely different. So I think when Christian artists allow themselves that kind of freedom, we get some of our best stuff.
I do. One more question. I know we're a little over an hour. I do fear, and I don't know enough to know if it's a legitimate fear, but when it comes to like quote unquote Christian worship music, has it lost its creative countercultural edge? Is mainstream Christian music basically doing all of the opposite things that we're talking about? Writing music that's primarily thinking of what will please the crowds. The money factor in specifically Christian music, I've heard people say, I mean, it can be, you land a hit worship song, you make millions, you know. I don't know if that's true, but I know there's a money factor there that could be a dangerous incentive. That's with everything, I guess. I mean, everything has that money incentive that could go south, you know. Or, you know, infamously, Christian music is not known for being super creative. Is that fair? I mean, to the musician, it just doesn't, it's just like, but maybe that's, you know, I've heard all people kind of push back and say, well, if it's going to be sung by the masses, you can't sing 2112 by the masses, you know. Yeah. Or why is,
yeah, my argument would,
why is Christian music a genre? Mm-hmm.
Well,
like, you don't have it, like Showbread could never be sung on Sunday mornings, I don't think. Maybe you do. Reggae is, everybody loves reggae. Who doesn't like reggae? But if we sang a reggae song, they'd be like, hey, when are we gonna sing a Christian worship song?
Totally.
How has Christian worship become kind of its own genre that's kind of this like white middle class contemporary rock kind of feel, and it doesn't go beyond that? Is that the way it has to be, or
no?
is that part of the market we've created?
We've created the market, unfortunately. We've created the palette, or we've allowed a handful of megachurch worship conglomerates to create a palette that we refuse, from which we refuse to deviate. And it's not even necessarily that the palette is in and of itself bad, you know? I have these critical sounding things to say about it, but it's really not about the aesthetic of you fill in the blank, you know, megachurch worship band that we all sing songs by in our various churches. Because some of it, you know, I might like a lot. Some of it might not be my personal taste, but that's fine. It's more about the fact that we don't allow ourselves to stray as communities from the rigidity of this rule book. You know, the pushback that you're citing, I've heard it too, and I get it, you know, that like, well, you want to accommodate a congregation to the degree that they can enter into a meaningful worship experience. And if you push too hard or go too far and you lose them, then it, you know, ostracizes the majority and wow, the minority is like, hooray, we're finally getting artsy. I get that, you know, and as an act of self-sacrificial love, you want to incorporate all kinds of sensibilities into the collective worship experience. But my argument would be that the reason that that sensibility often feels restrictive is because we are not teaching our people to go beyond that palette at all. We are not teaching them, you know, yeah, you can't sing something like Tom Sawyer by Rush at church. But why? Because we have not taught our people what it means to do something like that, you know? And if you enter into different kinds of, you know, like worship expressions in other traditions, you know, obviously the kind of worship experience at an Eastern Orthodox church is going to look a lot different than a Protestant, a lot different than a Catholic. You know, you walk into an Eastern Orthodox worship gathering and see people kissing icons and you're going to be, what the heck is going on? But to them, this is this meaningful aesthetic gesture of the worship experience in the same way that they might think, like, what's up with all the delay pedals and, you know, like, sing song? Why does everything sound like U2? You know, or why does everything sound like Coldplay? Historically, unfortunately, mainstream Christian worship music, and I'm using broad strokes, obviously, I'm kind of being reductive, sure, but we've always been about 10 years behind. So our worship music is still on the heels of indie rock from the early 2000s. And we borrow from the standards handed down to us by whatever is popular at the time, whatever big worship band or bands are kind of setting the standard for, this is the kind of stuff you sing in church. We sing their songs. And we might adapt them slightly differently from congregation to congregation. But for the most part, those are the songs we're singing. And we're not teaching our people what it means to have a more robust understanding of what kind of aesthetic things can happen in a worship gathering. And this goes for my church as well. Like if you came to my church on a Sunday night, it would honestly look a lot like other mainstream non-denominational churches, and we sing songs by the big, you know, the known worship band. We sing other stuff too, but it's not like all of a sudden it would feel like some kind of subversive, wow, this is so different. But we are in the process, and this book is part of it. You know, I'm teaching a series at my church now about art and the Bible and God, and I want to give my community a sense of what it means to like have a wider palette, even if we can only push it open a little bit at a time. You know what I mean? And for us, that looks like, what does it look like to, you know, have long instrumental meditations for lament, you know, something that to a lot of other churches, they'd be like, sure. Yeah, we do that all the time. It's like, well, my people, that's new to my people. So we're trying to, you know, expand our horizons. What does it look like to reflect on a visual during worship? You know, like this is a painting that was meaningful to Christians throughout history while we play music, that kind of thing, which in the moment to our people is like, well, it's a little weird. We're looking at a painting in church, but okay, sure. You know, I'll go with it for now. And I think it's also part of we shouldn't depend on, you know, the mainstream Christian worship music machine to set the aesthetic standard for church in America.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're singing lament. That's I've been thinking about that for the last few months. It's hard for me to worship sometimes when it's all nothing but celebratory and victorious when you look around at the world. So, I mean, I've been doing just a ton of reading and listening on the whole Israel-Palestine issue, which is just heart-wrenching on so many levels. And it's like, I just haven't been able to worship at church because I'll, you know, wake up, I'll, you know, be reading a book or, you know, look at the news and just really kind of trying to follow what's going on there. You know, I mean, how many 10,000 dead kids getting every day, 10 kids get at least one leg amputated with no anesthetics. Like, can you imagine taking a chainsaw to your daughter's leg? Cause there's no anesthetic, like, because it's, she'll die because there's gangrene or whatever the case. Like, this is what some of whom are our brothers and sisters in Christ are going through, like, right now. And so then I go to church and sing songs and everything's perfect. God's victorious always, and he delivers us always delivers us, and he's always there and things always work out. He's so good. It's hard for me, yeah, to, like,
totally.
I don't know. Like, I don't want to be the jerk in the bag, arm folded. No, it's not good for everybody. Like, I used to be more like that. I really don't. I try to just go with it, you know, but it's just, sometimes it's just hard. Like, I wish that the Christian worship experience, as it's typically played in church, would respect the complex rhythms of life more honestly.
Yeah.
Is maybe how I would put it. And I don't know what that looks like.
Much like the Psalms.
Lament would be one. Like, there's Bibles filled with lament, and there's many things to lament over. And not that, even if that's 10 or 15% of what we sing about, at least, I don't know, just the full on, like, everything's peaches and cream, all the, you know, or I look around at the room and, like, statistically 25% of the women, at least in the church, have been sexually abused by usually somebody really close to them, father, husband, brother, sister, cousin. Most of the time they haven't worked through that. I'm looking around and they're just like, God's so good. And he is good. Like, I can believe God's good, but, like, are you being odd? Like,
yeah.
When do we express our pain or frustration? Yeah. Or when do we sing Psalm 88? You know, God, doesn't feel like you're here. Where were you when my father was sexually abusing me? You know, like, have we lamented that? Yeah. And I don't know.
I think that honestly has a lot to do with our limited palate, our limited aesthetic palate, because it's not just a question of philosophical approaches. It's an aesthetic approach of, well, I mean, it's a bummer and our people they want to worship, you know what I mean? I honestly feel like, and, you know, I have a different kind of sensibility. My church jokes with me all the time. It's like, you don't have to remind us we're going to die every single week, you know, like, so my mind goes to dark place, or is prone to kind of, like, reflect on the tragedy more than it is celebration. But I do find that framing celebratory worship with the profound evil that is such a common reality of our world makes our celebratory worship more subversive. And there's a way to enter into, a reflection on evil. And we spend every year in Advent, it's become a profound time for our community, but the first time that, you know, I do my most upsetting, darkest teachings throughout Advent, and tell some, like, horrible, horrible stories, leading.
I shouldn't be laughing. I love it. This is,
yeah. I think that, like, a time to like appreciate how incredible the Christmas story is. You have to frame it in, like, everything is so awful. And that's the world into which God is like, I'm here and I'm coming to rescue it. And, you know, I thought that no one would go with me the first time. I was like, this, hear me out, elders. This is what I'm thinking for Advent. But they're like, all right, let's try it. And people were telling me, like, geez, these Advent talks, they're so heavy. Like, this is really hard. But then the Christmas Eve gathering is, like, incredible. There's this sweeping, like, we kind of hold back on how much, you know, celebration we do. I mean, we sing some Christmas hymns and things like that, but we save some of our most celebratory moments for Christmas Eve. And then it's like, after for 4 weeks or longer, talking about death and despair and darkness and the long winter of the human experience, it's like, God came to save us. And suddenly it's like this profound, and even like on a Sunday to Sunday basis, to, you know, like it's not uncommon for us to, especially when something heinous evil is unfolding under the world lens, you know what I mean? To stand up and be like, we understand that this horrible things are happening in the world every day, but we all see this one. And we see it in a, like, because of the 24-hour news cycle, we see it in a explicit kind of way. And we should think about that and reflect on that. And we'll read a psalm together and we'll have time for meditation and prayer. But then if you enter into that kind of God is good song, it becomes an act of defiance against the evil in the world, and not just like an act of ignorance to try to like cover our eyes to the evil in the world, but instead being like, in spite of the heinous state of affairs that is life in the world, like he is who he says he is. And then it becomes this like incredible moment. But all that only happens if we have a wider appreciation for the kind of artistic reflection, aesthetic reflection that we can do in a worship gathering, you know?
Hey man, I gotta run. But man, this has been so good. Love talking with you and love your honesty, man. I really appreciate you and excited to dig into your book.
Oh man, I'm glad you had me again.
Thanks for coming on Theology and Raw again.
Yeah, of course.
This show is part of the Converge Podcast Network.